afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our Race to Net Zero conversation as we head into the afternoon of Sunday here on Tandanya on Kaurna country. My name's Marie Lowes, and we have some incredibly esteemed panelists here with me today. We're going to be talking about how a race to net zero has become law of the land by 2050 here on this country, on these countries around this island now called Australia. But in the race to net zero, who's leading who? Government or industry? So before we move into that part of the conversation and we start talking about what we're doing for the future and where governance sits and who's deciding what, I'd like to invite us all to close our eyes and really drop in on a cellular level to the legacies of decision-making and science and innovation that live in this country, in Kaurna country. Close your eyes. I promise there was talk of interpretive dance, but it won't be happening in the next 30 seconds. There's a millennia-old and evolving legacy of storytelling, of regenerative thinking, of decision-making based on the needs and wants and thriving of future generations that lives here. Well before we've come and walked around and listened to music and been part of today's fabric, and it will continue long, long, long after we're here. So I'd like to all take a moment to acknowledge the traditional owners of this country, to thank the ancestors for having us here, the non-human kin, the fabric of life to which we all belong, and also acknowledge any other traditional owners or First Nations people who are joining us here today, and all custodians and stewards around the world. All right. So let's meet our panelists today. Let's start with a big round of applause. So I have Polly Hemming here. Thank you, Polly, for joining us. Polly is the Acting Director of the Australia Institute's Energy and Climate Program. Now, we're lucky to have this conversation today thanks to the presenting partner, which is the Australia Institute. So can we give them a round of applause too? Hello, in the front row. And also thanks to Dr. Bronners, who is a supporting partner of this panel discussion. Now, Polly, you have extensive experience in policy and as well in marketing and engagement, and you also have a bit of a varied background. You've worked in remote Indigenous education, refugee advocacy, and in a couple of sentences, what's the bulk of the work that you're doing at the moment with your team at the Australia Institute?
Right. Excuse me. It's not a great start, is it? How's that sound? Right now, my work and the team of the work at the Australia Institute when it comes to climate is really focusing on something that we call climate integrity. And basically that's a way of flipping on its head all the other things we were working on, which is greenwash, environmental markets, fossil fuels. And instead of trying to, you know, point out the flaws in all these policy concepts or put out the fires of greenwash, we decided to turn it on its head and instead focus on something called climate integrity, which is the antidote to all those things.
Beautiful, thank you. Okay, now moving along this couch, we also have Bryn O'Brien. Give her a round of applause, please. There we go, everyone's welcome. So Bryn is an esteemed lawyer and strategist, and you were named in the top 200 green power players of 2022. And Bryn is joining us today as the Executive Director of the Australasian Centre for Corporate Responsibility. Bryn, you have an extensive background of engaging with stakeholders. Do you want to tell us a couple of sentences about what you do in your words?
Yeah, thanks very much, Marie. Great to be here. So ACCR is a research and shareholder advocacy organisation. We hold shares in major listed companies in Australia and in some markets abroad. And we use the rights that shareholders have under the relevant corporations law in the jurisdictions that we work in to try to change those companies. So our Australian share portfolio looks pretty ugly. It's the really big emitters, the BHPs, Rio Tinto, Santos, Woodside, Origin, AGL. And they're companies that so we have shareholdings in, and so probably do your super funds. And so we go and we really talk to those companies, we talk to their investors, and then we use a range of strategies, shareholder resolution and AGM action, as well as litigation under the Corporations Act to try to make those companies decarbonise in line with science.
Brilliant. Thank you. And on the end here we have Eitan Lenkrad. Please give him a round of applause as well. Now, Eitan, you have a background in tech, but you're working with Boundless Earth at the moment. You're the CEO. So Boundless Earth, for anyone who hasn't heard of them, was founded by Mike Cannon-Brook's Green Fund, and you're running a not-for-profit philanthropic organisation. You're doing some incredible work around pushing forwards with electric vehicles, with electrifying homes, and climate advocacy, and also climate jobs, is that right?
Yeah, so Boundless was formed sort of beginning of last year. We're part of Mike Cannon-Brook's climate pledge, you mentioned. And the way that Boundless works is that we pick a topic where we think we really need to accelerate momentum, because we think momentum is such an important theme in climate, we need to get the balls rolling. We build a strategy around that theme, and then we've got the opportunity to deploy philanthropy and also direct investing, and also, you know, Mike Cannon-Brook's does have a bit of a profile, so we've got the opportunity to use direct advocacy as a tool as well. And so he gave some examples where we work with electric vehicles, home electrification, and at the moment we're in the middle of it, we call them epics, an epic around getting 100,000 new people in Australia working in climate jobs by 2027.
That's pretty epic. All right, please give Eitan a round of applause. So we all know that language matters, and there's a lot of terms that are thrown around. I'd like to start this afternoon with you, Polly. If we can have a chat about decarbonisation, what does decarbonisation mean, and how does it really fit in the race to net zero?
Decarbonisation is what it sounds like. It's essentially taking carbon, or removing or eliminating carbon out of our processes across the economy. So when we decarbonise our electricity system, we're not using coal, combusting coal for electricity. We're using renewable energy, wind or solar, for our electricity. The way that decarbonisation fits into net zero, well, actually it doesn't have to fit into net zero, to be honest. You don't have to be decarbonising to get to a state of net zero, unfortunately. And I thought it might be useful to actually give you a definition of what net zero actually is, because we hear it everywhere. You know, it's in advertising, it's in policy, it's news reporters just talk about net zero. But polling by the Australia Institute shows that while a majority of Australians have heard the term net zero, only about 15% of Australians actually know what it means. And that's fine, that's totally reasonable, because most of the time I don't know what it means either. And it's because there is no set definition by governments or, the intergovernmental organisations of what net zero is. Technically, it's just an accounting equation, like emissions out are compensated or balanced by emissions in somewhere else. So, you know, someone plants a tree, effectively sucking carbon or avoiding carbon by not cutting down a tree, but you can keep emitting. So while we want decarbonisation as part of net zero, that's actually not what is happening. It is a concept that can be gamed incredibly easily. There's no definition. It can mean anything and everything for fossil fuel companies who, and actually it's high emitting companies that are more likely to set net zero targets, because it's a really beautiful way of greenwashing. It's basically for someone like Woodside or Santos, who are rampantly increasing their gas extraction, a sort of, what does net zero feel like to me? Like a interpretive dance, really. It's a, how does it feel? You know, I might count some of these emissions and I'm going to keep emitting over here, but I won't count that in what my net zero target is. And then in the future, like we've got till 2050, by the way, we don't have to do anything until 2049. And then around 2049, we might invent some technology that can suck a whole lot of CO2 out of the atmosphere. And that's literally, it sounds absurd, but that's literally how companies like Woodside and big gas and coal companies define net zero. And I've actually got Woodside's net zero target. Is it alright if I read it?
It
takes a while because it's quite lengthy. And to be clear, that's not what you see on the website. You just see in big red writing, you know, net zero by 2050. But this is net zero. This is Woodside's interpretive dance. This is how net zero feels to them. Target is for net equity scope 1 and 2 greenhouse gas emissions relative to a starting base of the gross annual average equity scope 1 and 2 greenhouse gas emissions over 2016 and 2020 and may be adjusted up or down for potential equity changes in producing or sanctioned assets with an FID prior to 2021. Post completion of the Woodside and BHP Petroleum merger, which remains subject to conditions including regulatory approvals, the starting base will be adjusted for the then combined Woodside and BHP Petroleum portfolio. So effectively,
everyone got that?
You got that?
Yeah.
Because there's going to be
really clear, isn't it?
So effectively, Woodside is saying it is going to be net zero balanced for partly net zero for some of its emissions. So that's what we're dealing with when we talk about net zero. So decarbonisation should be what we're aspiring to, reducing emissions as much as possible, eliminating all carbon, and then possibly balancing them out. But I just wanted to make clear, if you don't understand what net zero is, that's fine, you're not meant to.
I can just give a quick example. I told Maria I was going to go off script, but just to show how, so first of all, I think in that definition, you're talking about Woodside scope 1 and 2, and so they're only, so it's Woodside scope 1 and 2 emissions, and this is emissions accounting, but I think it's about 10% of their total emissions. Most of their emissions are what's called scope 3, or it's 3%, right? It's the emissions from the stuff that they sell to be burned. So in that definition, they're not talking about that at all. The other thing I would say is I can give you an example of Shell. So Shell, big, massive super major, our research last year showed that the way that they were promising to reduce offsets using tree planting showed, basically they have said they are going to plant, in equivalent terms, a non-pine forest that will be mature by 2030 that is the size of Washington State. So just kind of get that in your head. That's how many trees they're going to plant.
Thanks, Bryn. So, Bryn, you work a lot with engaging stakeholders on an international level, and stakeholders hold more power than ever domestically and internationally with government decision-making. What's some of the work that you're doing to engage stakeholders to take more accountability, to be truly transparent, and how can citizens, consumers, be part of that story in a more meaningful way?
Thanks. So the main stakeholder group that ACCR talks to is shareholders, institutional investors that own parts of these huge companies who have such an impact on us and on our atmosphere. For a lot of those investors, they might represent like the people in this audience. They might be your super fund, they might be an asset manager that you somehow have a relationship with. And a bunch of that kind of set of stakeholders, they have their own climate commitments. So often they'll be saying that they are getting to zero. So I kind of echo Polly's words in that net zero from an investment perspective, from a portfolio decarbonisation perspective is basically nonsense. Like, we can't divest our way to a safe planet. We can't do that. So what we encourage those shareholders to do is to use the tools, again, the rights that they have under the corporations law, to aggressively engage with those companies to try to achieve changes to the business strategy that result in ultimate real-world emissions reductions. And where those conversations fail, then we start looking at renewal of the boards of those companies to try to get people in place who will see that change happen. On the side of regular citizens, I think that the most powerful thing that citizens can do, and we saw it in the last federal election, is vote. We now have, I heard Polly refer to it as a climate supermajority, actually, in Parliament now. Huge, you know, there is change now that is possible that was not possible under the last government. They're not going nearly fast enough, as we all know. But that's what regular citizens can do.
I love that. That's great. What was it, a climate super
majority?
supermajority, a climate supermajority. So moving along to you, Eitan, the work that you're doing with Boundless Earth, I saw a tweet recently that said that the two biggest issues of concern for an average household in Australia are energy prices and climate change. Now, those two for an average, you know, set of parents or an average householder, they don't always go hand in hand. They seem to be competing, especially with existing market forces. How can we move towards average houses being able to afford energy that's safe for the future, that's safe for us, and also still afford the cost of living?
Yeah, I think there's a perception there, I mean, in that question, which I think was the common perception, is that by decarbonising whatever it is, our households, our economy, that's a cost that we have to bear that's more expensive than what we're doing now, and so you're going to have to sacrifice, or you're going to have to pay more to do your house, where, you know, the cost, you know, part of the reason that we think of acting on climate as a momentum play is that, particularly around technology, once you start deploying things and the volumes of these things start going up and we get better at making them, the cost of them comes down, so you have these cost curves. So, for example, in people's houses, you know, what we're trying to do is say, you know, there's a lot of research now that shows if you have an electrified home, your heating, your hot water, your cooking is all cheaper than if you're using gas to do it, not to mention much more healthy. All the research is coming out about increased asthma risk and things like that from having gas cooktops in your home. So if it's cheaper and you've got, you know, the cost of those technologies coming down, and at the same time we've got things like the crisis in Ukraine, which is what's driving issues such as the cost of gas going up and people getting worried about cost of living and energy prices, and so we're seeing a reaction to that, particularly in Europe, to be deploying more of the technologies that solve the problem, so heat pumps and electric hot water heaters. And so now the volumes of those being manufactured are going up, and we're seeing in America with the Inflation Reduction Act huge incentives to install those as well. So those technologies are getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And so this old perception that people had, if I have to do those things, it's going to be more expensive, is like outdated. And that's not anyone's fault. It's just things are moving really fast. And you know, sometimes you need to be an expert to keep up on where things are at. So Boundless did an epic end of last year around home electrification. And a lot of that was, you know, how do we make it easier? How do we make it easy for people to electrify their homes? How do we get awareness up of what the benefits are? How do we make sure that the rules of the playing field are stacked in electrification's favour? Like, until recently, at least in Victoria, if you built a new house, you know, you had to get it connected to the gas grid. Like, that's just been, you know, pulled back. But still, you know, it should be gas, you know, it should be a ban. Any new house shouldn't be allowed to be connected to the gas grid, because you're connecting a stranded asset that's going to cost people a lot of money connected to their home. So, you know, that's the way that we've been thinking about it.
Thank you. So there was some talk of a bit of tension and a tussle around some topics. I'd like to go there now. I think no better time than the present. Let's talk about the over-amplification of responsibility that's placed on citizens, on individuals, around achieving climate action within the time frame that we have. There's some varying opinions here. Bryn, would you like to start to talk about that topic?
So fossil fuels companies have spent the last two decades making us all feel bad for the way we consume, right? They've spent the last two decades telling us that everything's on us and that you can't have an opinion about decarbonisation if you've got an iPhone. I don't know why that one always comes up, but it does. So I think really that we are we're in a battle at the moment. There's an us and them. The us is big. The them is small. The them is those interests, or those parties in whose interests further delays to decarbonisation make sense over the short to medium term. In the long term, further delay, everyone loses, right? We don't have an atmosphere in which people can have secure food and water, much less have stable financial markets. So the them is actually the incumbent electricity providers, it's the oil and gas companies, it's the major extractives companies. That's actually a really small them. The us is really big. So I think, again, coming back to the levers of power that we have, if we are now electing governments and we're electing them in part because we want aggressive decarbonisation, I think that's where our responsibility is to keep that pressure on, is to keep talking to those people who represent us, and not in feeling bad because we're not at, we sometimes make silly consumer choices.
That's a really good point. Like, we're so often led to believe that, if you buy a keep cup, and if you recycle, and if you minimise your plastic, and if you get solar panels, and if you do this and this and this and this and this, then the climate will be fixed, basically. And that's quite a deliberate strategy, as Bryn said, on behalf of the fossil fuel industry, but also the government as well. It's a really good way of saying, well, Australians, we've all got to do better. Like, we're all doing our bit, and what are you guys doing? And I'll just give you an example. So Origin Energy, gas company, Bryn knows a lot more about them than I do, but they had this campaign called, I think it was like 30 days of action or something. And they were saying things like, you've got to do your bit for climate, and you've got to do your bit for the planet. One of the suggestions was like, on a hot day, don't put the aircon on, eat an icy pole. It's like, well, how about don't open up a massive gas basin? Maybe that might do a little bit more for the climate. So, just outrageous. They're worse. I wish I had them written down. But, the idea that you can solve climate by buying a keep cup is not a burden that you have to take on. Buy a keep cup by all means, they're handy. But please don't feel guilty that you are doing everything in your power to reduce your emissions, because you're up against something massive. The government does not yet have adequate transport plans for electric vehicles. Eitan can speak to that, but they're not doing the heavy lifting, but they're putting the burden on you to do it, and your individual actions, from a consumer perspective, really aren't going to make much difference. We're still pumping out plastics. We don't have the transformation across the economy that gives you those easy purchasing choices, or makes things, even like solar panels or batteries, affordable. But having said all that, you can't divest yourself of responsibility entirely. This is where, Bryn keeps saying, this is where voting is really important, and that's why we have the climate supermajority, and I'll explain what that is. So clearly we have a majority government, or Labor has a majority in Parliament, but we also have a number of Greens in the Senate, and we have the Teals, the independent candidates who were elected on a platform of integrity and climate, and so they're all pushing for more on climate. We do have a Labor majority, but we've got a climate supermajority, and that was you. So I will wrap up, but I was just going to say that this session is called, who's winning the race to zero? Is it business or is it government? And they're both doing a pretty shithouse job, actually. No one is leading it. And the people who is winning it is you, is the people who voted in the climate supermajority, who are the people who are complaining to the ACCC and complaining to ASIC, and who are complaining to ag standards, and who are getting angry, the people who are attending protests. You are actually doing far more than you know, but probably still carrying a lot of guilt about the fact that you're still driving around in an internal combustion engine car.
I don't know if this counts as contention, because I agree with most of what you're saying, but and usually I'm arguing on the other side of this argument, basically what you're saying, but we're working on, Boundless is working on this people epic at the moment, and through that process it occurred to me something that's pretty simple, but I don't know why I haven't worked it out before, but something really tangible that people can do on climate, aside from all the obvious stuff, is take their skills and apply them to climate. Like, yes, it's not often presented that way. If you're an accountant, go and work at a company as an accountant that's doing stuff on climate. Obviously, if you're an engineer, and there's more obvious professions, but pretty much any profession can be doing what you do, but doing it at a company or an agency or an organisation that's trying to move things forward on climate. And you know, those companies are actually starved of talent at the moment, and they're looking for people. And if you really want to be charitable, then, you know, consider taking a bit of a pay cut if you need to get in that job. You know, your career is going to be future-proofed and much better off in the long term, so it's probably worth thinking that way in the short term. But also, you're starving the companies that are doing bad stuff from talent. And that's actually one of, you know, we often talk about legal challenges and finances and all that stuff, but it's actual people that are doing this stuff. So if they don't have the people, they can't do it as effectively, and things get slowed down, and those tipping points where the market, you know, the clean technologies take over, comes closer. So I think that counts as contention. That's my point.
Yeah, I feel like we're agreeing too much.
But on that point, I mean, it's a fabulous point you make in terms of the workforce. So ACCR, we're interesting workforce, right? We've got a couple of really senior oil and gas engineers that came to work with us recently, investment bankers, stockbroker, a bunch of corporate lawyers who have done exactly that and could be earning multiples of their wage out there and working for an oil and gas company or facilitating fossil fuels expansion. And they're not doing that. So there's real momentum. We're seeing a huge amount of momentum out of the private sector at the moment and people that are really wanting to put their professional skill sets to work for our future.
Yeah, we recently, there's a tech accelerator called StartMate, and as part of this EPIC, we challenged them to offer a climate fellowship, and they were like, oh, all right, fine, you know, if we can get a decent number. So they had a conference last year, and we announced this thing. We challenged the audience that if 200 people signed up for this fellowship, they would run it, and they're kind of like, all right, 200 people, that's worthwhile us running. So then we heard a few weeks later, how many people signed up? They had 1,600 people signed up for it. And that was without any marketing, you know, with any campaign around it. It was just a massive late demand. I mean, it'd be interesting to see, you know, put up your hands here if you'd be interested in working in a job, you know, as your professional career in something that was doing things for climate. Put up your hands if you'd be interested. So I think we've got to recognise that's actually this huge opportunity for Australia. And that's the first time we've ever done audience participation, by the way. So thanks for not embarrassing me.
I mean, it sounds like we can take action and we need to take action, but we are still currently in a system that is not set up to truly and honestly meet our net zero target by 2050. Let's talk about the H word, hope. We're talking theory here, right? But as people who work on the front line of climate realities, which, you know, all the reports are in, we know that we're at a tipping point in humanity and planetary boundaries and biodiversity loss. In your hearts, not in your minds, but in your hearts, how do you each stay connected to what's possible? And do you feel hope?
Where do we start?
Yeah, I'll start. I don't know if I feel hope. I feel just simmering, relentless rage. Okay. Sometimes just garnish that with a bit of fear, existential fear. I honestly don't feel I have any other option, and it's a luxury for me to say that. You know, I left the public service because I found it untenable working under the Coalition and the gas-fired recovery, but I was very lucky to get the job that I did. So I have placed no judgment on people who, you know, don't abandon a job to go and work on climate, though what Eitan said was fantastic. I've got two kids, and this will sound very trite, a little sort of cliched, but they don't give me hope, they shit me to tears. But the only, doing the work I do is the only way I can look at them and say, I tried. Yeah, so that's kind of what motivates me. And then, of course, we just have this magnificently beautiful and incredible wild world, and it's so worthy of protecting, and there's so many different species that can't speak for themselves that I know this does sound cliche, but I actually mean it. I feel an obligation to care for them, and I feel being in the role that I have is an incredible privilege, and that not everyone can be as, sit up here on a stage and really give it to both industry and government, completely freely, so I do feel like I have a responsibility to speak on behalf of the people who donate to us and follow us and, you know, say what they can't.
This will come as no surprise to anyone, but I'm very firmly on the rage train. I am all about it. So motivating. Hope to me, kind of relevant. Like, rage, there's movement, right? Like, we're going somewhere. The most important thing there's two important things. The most important thing for me is momentum. It's a word that Eitan has used. It's that we're putting one foot in front of the other and we keep going. And my fear with the kind of hope stuff is that, well, if you run out of hope, does that mean you stop? You never run out of rage. Rage is a renewable resource. So if you can just keep putting one foot in front of the other, because the reality of the situation we're in is every ton of carbon counts, every pipeline, every project that we can stop, every drill site matters. And so we can't let the possibility that we run out of hope get in the way of achieving that. And I think Holly touched on another point, which I think, you know, you're talking about the beauty in the natural world. I describe that as wonder, and my ability to access awe and wonder and joy at like a music festival like this. That's the stuff that being on the line, like everything's on the line. Everyone you have ever known, every descendant you may ever have, everything is on the line now. And so for that to be under threat, for the just wonder and awe in our home planet to be under threat, that makes me really angry. And that's gonna keep me going when we might not have too much hope. It's a bit depressing. Anyway, Eitan, over to you.
I don't know if I can do rage permanently. I just get too many heart palpitations and collapsed. I'm more on the optimistic side. I mean, I used to be in software, and there were just so many times in software you had a project that had to be out the door done in like 2 weeks' time. And you do, you know, all the logical analysis of it, and you had like 6 months of work or something to do in that 2 weeks, and there was just no possible way you could do it. And you just pulled insane late nights, where, you know, you would just somehow get it done because you had to get it done and there was no option. That's kind of how I feel about climate at the moment. I mean, Elon Musk, very controversial, but he's like, he does have one quote that I like, which is, "I'd rather be optimistic and wrong than pessimistic and right." And that's kind of how I feel. Like, you know, I think we've got to give it a go. There are so many positive signs. Like, we talked about all the bad stuff, but, you know, technology follows kind of exponential curves of adoption. We've all seen that in things like iPhones and lots of other stuff. So, you know, by creating momentum, by getting the ball rolling, kind of get this acceleration effect, and then hopefully it washes a lot of the bad guys away, and obviously we need to push them and make sure that we're kicking them when they're down as well.
These guys aren't going to get washed away.
No.
I think that's the problem. Like, we actually are in a fight.
They're like, they're parasites. They're in our government, they're in our banks, they're everywhere. The parasite analogy cannot be overstated enough. They have buried their way. So, sorry, okay.
No,
well,
go, no, please, this is
the
great.
Rage. So just to give you an example, the Australian Climate Change Authority, independent statutory authority, is legislated by the federal government to give the government advice on its climate targets. That's in our new climate bill. It's been around for a long time. But the chair of the Climate Change Authority is a former gas executive.
And lobbyist.
Long history, you know, making no allegations. Then he's the chair of the Climate Change Authority. Then he's also the chair of Australia's biggest carbon offset developer. I haven't even gotten to offsets yet. So no matter what Australia's climate policy does, if it swings to fossil fuel heavy, then he wins because he's, you know, fossil fuel advocate, but he also wins because fossil fuel companies are using offsets to greenwash their production. Like, the fact, it baffles me that no one has said, should we really be having a former gas executive leading this independent body? And you can pick all Australia's climate agencies, and these fossil fuel executives are just dotted throughout government. They're dotted throughout Parliament, actually. They're everywhere. And then they're Grant King is also chair or director of Making No Allegations of Impropriety, chair of HSBC, so he's in the banks. Like, it is a parasitic relationship. And I agree, yeah, we need to wash them away, but it's going to take a lot more. It's going to take full sheep dip. It's going to take ICAC.
It's going to need the water cannons.
It's going to need the water cannons. It's going to need, you know, transparency measures, integrity commission, lots of, literally robo-debt type inquiries to get them out.
Yeah.
It can be done, just ad hoc, but, yeah.
Two more questions and then we'll come out to the audience for a couple of question and answers with you good folk. Can we offset our way out of further expansion of fossil fuels?
No. You know what? Offsets are ultimately being used to expand fossil fuels. And again, polling by the Australia Institute shows that most Australians say they don't really understand what offsets are or what carbon neutral is. So I'll just quickly explain it. There's these things called carbon credits, and they are given to individuals or businesses across the economy for carrying out certain activities that reduce or avoid CO2, mostly in the land sector. So you'd think planting trees, mostly not, just not cutting down trees or putting fence around an area and trees are allowed to regenerate. Those projects are given carbon credits, and then the owners of those projects can either sell the carbon credits, they sell them to a business who wants to use that ton of CO2 that's been reduced or avoided to justify emitting a ton of CO2 themselves. So basically, it's bonkers. And that's not to say that we shouldn't be not cutting down trees, and we should be regenerating trees, we should be preserving ecosystems, absolutely we should, but we've created this market, we've financialised doing that. So me over here hasn't cut down a tree, so Woodside can continue emitting. And the idea with offsetting has always been that, okay, we do have some industries that are really genuinely going to struggle to decarbonise. Like, how do you decarbonise agriculture? Can't electrify a cow. Eitan probably can. Yeah, that's a challenge. Seaweed. Seaweed, yes, really great idea. But we've been talking about seaweed for ages. It's basically the green version of carbon capture and storage. How are you going to get seaweed across all Australia's cows? And I won't get into, I'm going to assume that we want to keep our beef industry, okay? I won't talk about, you know, we just don't eat meat. But seaweed is a really lovely idea, but it's just not practical. We need to reduce emissions at the source. We need to, so moving away from ag, we need to just stop emitting in the first place. And we can do that by not extracting massive amounts of fossil fuels. And no one's saying we do this overnight, but we need to stop approving new gas and coal projects. We just stop at the source. Do fund things like, not cutting down, paying farmers not to cut down trees. Sorry, I've deviated a bit. So offsetting, can we offset our way to net zero? Yeah, we can on paper, sure, no worries. Most of the offsets in Australia are junk, by the way, and internationally. So the result is always, even if you've balanced out your emissions on paper, is a net increase. On paper, sure, we could say where we've balanced everything out, but physics says something quite different.
I hear you. I'd love to throw to you, Bryn, on this, but looking at the time, I'd like to ask, so we're hearing a lot of messaging out there that's saying, yes, we're committing, this is in terms of businesses and the private sector, yes, we're committing to net zero, but that's not necessarily the truth. We're talking about greenwashing. How can consumers diversify their information sources and learn about the true actions of some of the biggest climate crime perpetrators?
Look, it's really hard. I'm just going to call it, like, trying to assess a company's decarbonisation plan is a tough thing. Like, I just don't know that it's feasible for consumers to be out there looking at the, you know, how legitimate those commitments are. So I think We need much stronger action from regulators in this country. We need ASIC and the ACCC to be looking at what companies are doing, and they've started to do that, but they're not going nearly hard enough. So ACCR, we sued Santos a couple of years ago. We're still in court against them, so I can't say too much about what I think about their plan, but you can infer from the fact that we've sued them that I don't love it, right? So we've taken to Santos, big massive South Australian, right, oil and gas company, to the federal court under both the consumer law that the ACCC is supposed to enforce, and ASIC, and the Corporations Act, which ASIC is supposed to enforce. But we and an NGO are doing it because they haven't. So look, I think supporting those that are doing it. We've got fabulous lawyers at the Environmental Defenders Office, supporting, you know, organisations like the Australia Institute doing incredible research, busting greenwashing. It's really important, but making sure that when you do cast your vote, you're voting for more integrity around this stuff, and you're having those conversations within your spheres of influence.
When we talk about corporates, we start thinking about the oil and gas and coal companies. Fair enough, and they're baddies, and there's not a lot we can do there. But if you think about the full spread of corporations in Australia, you've got this X percentage that's, you know, the oil and gas, they're really embedded in the fossil fuel industry. You've got, on the other side, companies that are developing renewable energy projects and are directly involved on the clean side of things. And then you've got, like, you know, the 80-90% of companies in the middle that are companies like Telstra or whatever that are just doing kind of day-to-day stuff. And sure, they should have, you know, zero emissions plans and all that sort of stuff, but it's not their kind of core business. And what we need is those, you know, because at the moment it's kind of portrayed as a 50-50 kind of thing, because it's the companies on the ends that we look at. We're actually, it's probably more like a 90-10 thing. And we need those companies in the middle to start stepping up. And I think what we see, you know, I think for many years companies, you know, it's business, it's the market, you know, they look at the activists as like this, you know, that's just a totally different thing. That's not us, that's just something different that we don't get involved with. Unless you're a fossil fuel company, by the way, you understand the benefit of activism. But, you know, if you look in America, where the activists have been really effective, and you've got the Inflation Reduction Act that's passed over there, and that's going to inject literally trillions of dollars into the economy there towards decarbonisation and other projects. And that's going to benefit not just the 10 at the end, it's going to benefit the 90% of companies that aren't directly involved in fossil fuel extraction. It's just going to create a huge amount of momentum in the economy there. They're bringing manufacturing back, and there's a whole lot of stuff that's going to happen. And so those companies, you know, haven't just a little bit benefited from the activism and advocacy that got the Inflation Reduction Act passed. You know, it's put a massive tailwind behind them. You know, factories are being built. You know, these companies are going to make a lot of money thanks to the work of those activists. So I think that 90% of companies needs to get involved in Australia, even if it's just for self-interest, that decarbonisation is a really good economic opportunity for most companies in Australia, except
for fossil fuels. Why isn't Telstra calling for no new gas and coal? Like, where are they? They're just silent.
Yeah.
It's not good enough.
Yeah, we've got to stop being bullied. And, you know, I think Australia, the context to remember is that Australia is the world's biggest exporter of coal and, you know, pretty much the world's biggest exporter of liquefied gas. And we see that as some kind of advantage or some kind of good thing. You know, if we were the world's biggest exporter of typewriters and it was 1982, you know, we'd probably be worried about personal computers and stuff like that coming down the line. And we're not worried about that. So, you know, not only that 90% of companies and all of us should be advocating to move off coal and gas as a source of export market for Australia, because it's the right thing to do for climate, but it's also dangerous to base your economy on an obsolete technology that's going away pretty quickly as well. So
it would be a resilient decision to be making.
Yeah
absolutely. Well, I'm mindful of the time, and I'm sure that there are questions out here in the audience. Where are our helpers with the microphones? Good friends in the red shirts. Thank you. Okay, so we have a question here in the middle. If you could please bring the microphone down here. Yep, the gentleman in the black shirt. And I just ask everyone this afternoon, we have a lovely big audience, if we can please keep it to questions rather than statements or stories, questions that we all are keen to hear the answers to.
Thanks. This is open to anybody on the panel. I was wondering if you could talk to decarbonisation and the circular economy and Australia's role in the potential of the circular economy, both Australia-wide and globally.
Circular economy isn't my area at all. I think it's a good thing, but...
Yeah, I'll briefly talk about it. I mean, well, how do I not be too controversial about this? I mean, obviously circular economy is a great thing. And, you know, the circular economy concept is that your outputs are your inputs, and so, you know, it sort of becomes a bit more of a closed loop, and you're minimising waste and all that sort of thing. I think electrification, which is a big source, a big, you know, when I think of the, you know, really simply how you talk about decarbonisation in the original question, it's like electrify everything and power it all with renewables. And just that in itself is a massive efficiency step. If you think about cooking something on a gas cooktop, like, you know, we've got an induction cooktop at home, and I cook and I move the pot around. The pot's never hot because the heat is going directly into the food. It's super efficient. Every time I get an Airbnb, and that has a gas cooktop, I always end up burning my hands because I forget that the heat is kind of heating everything up, and it's not just the food. So there's a huge efficiency step in electrification itself. And, you know, we think about the solar panels and the batteries and all these things we're going to deploy and how we recycle them. I mean, the good news is that there are, you know, rare and critical minerals and a lot of things that are quite valuable. So there's already companies that are coming up in America that can effectively recycle batteries, that can recycle solar panels. So it'll come down to everything else. Like, does the cost of recycling turn out to be cheaper than the cost of the inputs? And we need to kind of make sure that that's the way things go, and regulation has a big role to play in that. But, you know, we've got a lot of work to do, and so I don't think we should slow down. We need to work out these problems as we're going, not start until we've worked it all out.
Thank you. Okay. Making sure I clock everyone. We've got someone up the front here. We've got a lady up the front. Thank you.
Is there a danger that all of our renewable electricity resources that we build are used for hydrogen production instead of feeding into our domestic energy?
Good question. I don't think there's a danger because the renewable, where it still won't be enough. The 82% renewables in the grid by 2030 is just going to meet our needs for the grid. We need far more renewables before we even get to hydrogen. I understand what you're asking, but, you know, things like critical mineral processing, if we want to create new forms of exports, then we need to be doing things like critical minerals processing, and you know, hydrogen does have a role in steel manufacture, and we need to be doing that as well. But I don't think that currently we're going to be producing such an abundance that it's all going to go into hydrogen. I think hydrogen is largely hype, and I would be surprised if it's realised to the extent that everyone says it's going to be. But as it stands, we're going to struggle to get to that 80%. 82% in the grid as it is. We need much, much more just for electrification.
Just quickly, like the hydrogen, most hydrogen proposal projects are kind of off-grid, they're not connected to the grid, because you have to have green, you know, the hydrogen people want is green hydrogen anyway, and the grid, while it's not 100% green, you know, is not capable of making green hydrogen. So the bigger projects are all talking about off-grid wind and solar. Up, but agree on your point.
Thanks, Nathan. Just behind you there, we've got a gentleman sitting down on the grass.
Is this work? Oh.
Yeah.
Thank you. Great talk. Could you talk to the integration, maybe even the redemption of people working in these, you know, fading fields, fossilised fuels, fields, and into the new, you know, industry that we're creating?
So, I'm kind of interested in the word redemption, right? My organisation, ACCR, is judgment-free zone. I started my career as a corporate lawyer. exciting. But I think there's absolutely there's huge opportunity, and you know what better way, I guess, to atone for past work than using the skills that you have accrued in that work to try to stop the worst stuff going forward. I think to the integration point, maybe you want to talk to that, Etan?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Like, you know, there's such a focus in the climate movement around a just transition and making sure that communities that are fossil fuel intensive have a plan, a transition, you know, which we're totally on board with, and we're doing work at the moment around in the people epic. But it's just interesting to reflect that this is probably the first technological transition where anyone's ever given a shit about the people displaced from that transition. Now, when the car industry shut down in South Australia, did people agonise for 5 years before that around what's going to happen to the car workers and what's the new job they're going to move into? They didn't. They just shut it down, and people had to kind of work it out. And there was probably some emergency funding that came in from public money to support them. Where, you know, we're talking at the moment, there's a debate in government about an energy transition authority. There's things like the Hunter Jobs Alliance and lots of focus on in each of those areas, the Hunter in Gladstone and Latrobe Valley in Victoria, on what jobs people can move into. And, you know, I guess the simplest way to think about it is people think about, oh, well, you know, you're going to take a coal worker and they're going to be installing solar panels, and that's a less paid job, and that's not a good, you know, it's not a, and it doesn't use their skills. But, you know, it's not a like-for-like thing. You know, if you use a cheap renewable energy somewhere like the Hunter to supply manufacturing and turn that into a big manufacturing precinct, then someone from a coal power station could go and work in the manufacturing industry in that region. And even though they're not, you know, directly producing energy, they're working in a factory or working in a manufacturing industry that's being powered by clean energy. So, you know, that's a climate job in my eyes.
Thank you. We have time for one more quick question just down here. Where is our friend? Yeah, thank you. We do need to be quick because we need to be off the stage for the next talk.
Very quick. What do the panel recommend that Labor should do about the current position that they're faced with the Safeguard Mechanism Bill? Say yes to the Greens and ban new mines and gas, and get wedged by the Libs for breaking promises, or stay firm and potentially see their bill fail if the Greens vote against it?
Okay, so we're just going to cancel the next session because I've got to take an hour to answer this, all right? Sorry, everyone. No one is moving. The Safeguard Mechanism is a terrible policy, and it is Australia's key emissions reduction policy, and it doesn't tackle the number one thing making climate change worse, that are making emissions worse, fossil fuels. I just have so much ready to come out. In terms of what Labor should do, so remember this is a coalition policy. It was never designed to reduce emissions. It was designed to give like an illusion of regulatory accountability, and it was terrible. All Labor is doing is enforcing it, but actually making it worse. It's giving the illusion of regulatory accountability by making big polluters theoretically have to stay under pollution limits year on year. But at the same time, it's offering them the very reason that they don't have to reduce their emissions, unlimited offsets at a suppressed price. So if I was the Greens, which I'm not, and I have no influence, I would be holding strong on my No New Fossil Fuels campaign. And if I was Labor, I would remember that I was voted into government because I'd made a promise. Like, if you want to talk about making promises, you promised to reduce emissions by 43% by 2030. By continuing to approve new gas and coal projects that are increasing our emissions, and then by creating this veneer of regulation, you are actually breaking your promise. And I think it's really important to remember in 2009, the Greens, you know, we've revised history and the Greens are now sort of painted as climate wreckers, but after that bit of legislation was not passed by the Greens, we actually got something much better. So if the Safeguard Mechanism is voted down, if it doesn't get passed, what's Labor going to do? Say, oh, well, we can't do anything now, that's it, we're not going to do anything on climate. That's not going to wash, and they're not going to get voted in the next election, or they certainly won't be voted in as a majority government. So to answer your question directly, I'm not sure if I got the last bit, but if I was Labor, I would be feeling very worried about what's going to happen at the next election if they don't actually come to the table and negotiate in some form, because they haven't suggested they're prepared to do that in any way, shape or form.
Thanks so much, Holly. Thanks for the question. Unfortunately, that does bring us to a close for this afternoon's session. I would love to thank the Australia Institute for being a presenting partner for today's panel. I'd love to thank Dr. Bronners. I'd love us to all please thank our panellists. We have Holly Hammond from the Australia Institute. We have Bruno Bryan from the Australasian Centre.